Welcome back. This is section 7 on this series on the Bible. And in the last section, we began to explain some of the prophecies foretelling the coming of what Jesus called the Son of Man. In the Kitab Igan, Baha'u'llah explains to us why some of these prophecies are so difficult to understand. Baha'u'llah wrote, "Know verily that the purpose underlying all these symbolic terms and abstruse allusions which emanate from the revealers of God's holy cause has been to test and to prove the peoples of the world, that thereby the earth of pure and illumined hearts may be known from the perishable and barren soil. But from time immemorial such hath been the way of God amidst his creatures, and to this testify the records of the sacred books." This is Baha'u'llah in the Kitab Igan, page 49. So Baha'u'llah is telling us here that the reason for these abstruse allusions and for these difficult passages is to test and to prove the peoples of the world. God is testing his creatures by seeing if they can figure these things out. And it has been shown in the past, in the writings of the apostles, we have seen that the New Testament writings are what have been termed hidden and mysteries, that we need to search the scriptures to try to understand what they are truly saying. And even Jesus himself said that it is possible to both see and to hear his teachings, but still not understand them. So, in this presentation, we are going to be continuing the commentary on the prophecies and trying to explain the hidden mysteries that are contained within them. Now, in the last section, it was demonstrated that in prophecy, it is possible for days to equal years in prophetic notation. Days can equal years in prophecy. The first prophecy was the 70-week prophecy from Daniel, and I showed that this prophecy predicted the death of Jesus. It predicted the coming of Jesus the Messiah, and it predicted his sacrificial death. The next number that I explained was the 2300 day or year abomination of desolation prophecy. And I showed that when you begin at the same date as the 70-week prophecy, the 457 B.C., and if you count forward 2300 days or years, it brings you to 1844. Now, Baha'is know that 1844 is the year that the young forerunner, the young gate, the young Bob, appeared and began to announce to the world to prepare themselves that the great Son of Man, the great world teacher, the great world Messiah, was soon to appear. And of course, Baha'u'llah is the one whose coming was foretold by the Bab. Now, I would like to continue with this commentary on some of the numbers and the prophecies. The next mysterious number that we will examine is the number 1260 days. Now, this number occurs more times in prophecy than any other prophetic number. And to complicate matters even more, this number appears in several different disguises. The number appears as 1260 days, but it also appears as 42 months, and it appears as 3.5 years, 3.5 days, or 3.5 times, 3.5 days, or 3.5 cycles. Now, these are all just different ways of saying the same thing, because there are 1260 days and 42 months, and likewise, there are both 1260 days and 42 months and 3.5 years or 3.5 times. The lowest common denominator of these numbers is the 1260. Now, there are statements made in the 7th and 8th chapters of the book of Genesis which tell us that a prophetic year can contain 360 days. Likewise, we also know that a circle or a cycle contain 360 degrees. Therefore, we can conclude that 3.5 years, or 3.5 times, or 3.5 cycles of 360 all equal 1260. As I said, this number appears repeatedly throughout the scriptures. For example, Jesus shows us the number 1260 seven separate times within three chapters of the same book. Now, the book is the book of Revelation, and there are two different scenes which contain this number. Let's take a closer look at these passages to see what Jesus was trying to tell us. Now, the first scene containing the number 1260 is found in the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation. Here, two witnesses appear, and these two men of God are confronted by an animal, a beast with seven heads and 10 horns. This beast kills these two witnesses, and their bodies lie dead in the street for 3 days and a half, or 3.5 cycles. This is in Revelation 11, verses 9 and 11. Now, referring back to the book of Daniel, we can see that in Daniel's book, he too confirms this prophecy of Jesus, and Daniel too restates it. This is what Daniel said, quote, "The beast shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and a dividing of time." That's 3.5 times total. So Daniel is saying that the beast will appear and that the saints will be given into his hand for 3.5 times. Now, in the same book, Daniel again restates this prophecy, this time in a different way. Daniel says, quote, "It shall be for a time, times, and half a time," that's also 3.5 times, "and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished." It's in Daniel 12. Now, when we compare these passages with each other, we can see that they all refer to the same time span, and that they all apparently indicate the same event. They're talking about the rise of this beast, this animal, and this animal trods the holy city underfoot, and he subdues the holy ones, the holy people of God. The key to understanding what these prophecies are saying, once again, lies in the numbers. 3.5 years, 3.5 times, or 3.5 cycles of 360 all equal 1260. If you take 3.5 times 360, it's 1260. Now, when we again use the day for a year principle that we used before, we can see that this beast, who, quote, changes times and laws, will, quote, scatter the power of the holy people for a 1260-year period of time. Now, let's keep this information in mind for a minute as we look at the next scene, which is found in the next chapter of the book of Revelation. Now, this scene also contains the number 1260. Now, in the very next chapter, which is chapter 12 of the book of Revelation, Jesus again shows us the number 1260, and he again shows us this beast, this time in a different setting. Now, in this scene, a woman appears. She is pregnant, and she gives birth to a, quote, man-child who was to rule all nations, unquote. Her child is the promised one, the Messiah, the Son of Man. Now, the same beast who killed the two witnesses in the last chapter again appears. And this time, it threatens the woman and her child. Now, Jesus tells us that, quote, "The woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God," unquote. Now, two different time periods are given to describe how long the woman remains hidden in the wilderness. Jesus tells us that she is protected and nourished for both, quote, 1,203 score days, 1,203 score days, that's 1,260 days, and he says that she is protected and nourished for, quote, a time and times and half a time, or 3.5 times. This is found in Revelation 12, verses 6 and verses 14. So we can see in this passage that Jesus just gave us conclusive proof that the 3.5 times actually does, in fact, equal 1260 days. Now, once again, when we use our day for a year principle, the 1260 days then becomes 1260 years. This means that according to these last 9 prophecies given by Jesus and Daniel, the Messiah will come after a 1260-year interval. Now, this still leaves us with a couple of questions. First, who is the beast? And second, when does this 1260-year period of time begin? And if we can determine the starting point of this prophecy, then we will be able to calculate when the Messiah is due to appear. Now, about 1,000 years before Christ was born, a prophet of God appeared. He's not well known in the West. His name is Zoroaster, and Zoroaster gave us the starting date of the 1260-year prophecy. Now, for those who might not have heard of Zoroaster before, I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. His life story was very similar to that of Moses. Now, like Moses, Zoroaster taught that there is only one God. Like Moses, he gave his people a code of laws. And like Moses, his social teachings and his moral principles inspired the rise of a new civilization. The Zoroastrian religion inspired the rise of the Persian Empire. And the Zoroastrian religion was the primary religion of the Persian Empire at the time of Daniel and Nehemiah. Now, there is also substantial evidence to indicate that the Persian kings, including Artaxerxes, were Zoroastrian. Now, if you remember, Zoroaster was the same compassionate king who not only gave the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, the one from Daniel, but he also paid for the rebuilding of the holy city and the temple. So the city of Jerusalem and the building of the temple in Jerusalem was paid for by a Zoroastrian king. Now, 600 years later, when Jesus was born, the New Testament says that wise men came from the east to find him. Now, did you ever wonder why these wise men would have traveled thousands of miles in great danger just to see a baby? It's because of the prophecies of Zoroaster. Now, Zoroaster's prophecies were so specific that the wise men knew that the time had come for the Messiah to be born. And the prophecies of Zoroaster very clearly predicted the birth of Jesus. Now, these wise men were Zoroastrian priests, and they had come to help the child who had been foretold in their prophecies. Now, if you know the story of the birth of Jesus, you'll know that it was at this time that King Herod had heard that a new king had been born, and Herod wanted to kill his new rival. So a decree went out that all infant sons should be killed. As a result of this, Joseph and Mary were forced to flee into Egypt with their infant son Jesus. Now, how do you suppose this poor family was able to pay for this expensive trip on such short notice? Where did they get the money? If you remember, one of the Magi's gifts to Jesus was gold. And this gift of gold from the Zoroastrians very possibly helped finance the trip into Egypt, which saved Jesus' life. So we can see from this context that the coming of the Magi, of the wise men from the east, very possibly was a rescue mission. Now, later on, as Jesus grew older, the language that he spoke was Aramaic. Now, Aramaic originally was the official language of the Persian Empire, and by Jesus' time, it had become the most commonly used language of the Hebrew people. In other words, Jesus spoke a Persian dialect. The language that Jesus spoke at one time was the official language of the Persian court, the Persian Empire. Now, these are just some of the more interesting links that you can find that bound the Persian Zoroastrians, Israel, and Jesus. There's one other link that's even more interesting and even more important. The prophet Zoroaster not only foretold the birth of Jesus 1,000 years before it happened, he also predicted a time when his own religion would decline and when his own followers would be overrun by what he called the forces of the Arabian, by the followers of Muhammad. Now keep in mind that Zoroaster predicted these things 1,600 years before Muhammad appeared in Arabia. Now, in the same prophecy, Zoroaster also gave us the starting point of the 1,260-year prophecy. In his book, The Dinkird, Zoroaster wrote, quote, "When 1,200 and some years have passed from the beginning, from the inception of the religion of the Arabian, a descendant of the Iranian or Persian kings will be raised up as a prophet." According to Zoroaster, the starting point of our 1,260-year calculation is the inception, or the starting date, of the religion of Muhammad. Now, the Baha'i writings agree with Zoroaster that the 1,260-year prophecy should be calculated from year one of the Islamic calendar. They also tell us that the scene described by Jesus in the book of Revelation referred to specific events which happened in early Islamic history. The Baha'i writings clearly tell us that these scenes foretold the rise and the development of an extremely destructive movement within the, quote, religion of the Arabian, within Islam. Now, before these passages in the book of Revelation can be understood, we first need to know a little bit more about the religion of Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was a true prophet of God. Muhammad lived in Arabia 6 centuries after Jesus, and he appeared to a people who were primarily pagan. These people worshiped gods of stone and wood. Now, Muhammad commanded these people to smash their idols, and he called upon them to worship the one true God, the God of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. Now, Muhammad's life story is remarkably similar to some of the Old Testament prophets. Like Abraham, and especially Moses, he not only was a compassionate spiritual guide, but he also was the leader of a nation of people. Like the other prophets of old, he too was strongly opposed by both the civic and religious leaders of his time and of his home. Now, although it took many years, Muhammad eventually overcame his enemies, and his teachings eventually unified what previously were hostile warring tribes into what became one of the most culturally and scientifically advanced civilizations of that era. Now, there also is a dark side to this story. Almost from the beginning, and especially shortly after the death of Muhammad, there was an immense power struggle which caused Islam to split into 2 major branches, the Shia sect and the Sunni sect. Now, these divisions are somewhat similar to the Catholic and the Protestant branches within Christianity. The members of the Shia sect believed that only select members of Muhammad's family should have been the legitimate leaders of Islam after Muhammad's passing. Now, these leaders from Muhammad's family line were called the Imams. Now, the other major sect of Islam, the Sunni sect, believes that the leaders or caliphs of Islam should have been selected by popular vote. Now, the Baha'i writings indicate that the rightful successor of Muhammad was Ali, Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law. The Baha'i writings also tell us that after Ali, the leadership of Islam should actually have passed on to other designated members of Muhammad's family. But as we look at the history of Islam, and as we look at its development, we can see that ultimately it really didn't matter which of the two methods of selecting leaders was correct. It really didn't matter which, the Sunni or the Shia, was right. Because within a relatively short period of time, both methods of selecting leaders was abandoned. What happened was, from the earliest days of the history of Islam, from the early days when Muhammad first began to teach, there was a rival family. They were called the Umayyad clan. And the Umayyads, in the beginning, were the most virulent enemies of Muhammad. Now, this clan, the Umayyads, arose to seize the leadership of Islam. The Umayyads were very rich, they were very powerful, and they were very influential. Now, the Umayyads originally, like everyone else, originally were pagans. And as such, they, in the early years, had become one of Muhammad's most treacherous enemies. The Umayyads did whatever they could to stop the rise of Muhammad's religion, this religion dedicated to only one God instead of idols. There was even one attempt by the Umayyads to murder Muhammad. Now, the Umayyads and some of the other clans of Mecca made life so difficult for Muhammad that eventually he was forced to relocate to the city of Medina. Now, even after this move, his enemies still sought to destroy him. Three times the people of Mecca sent armies to destroy Muhammad and his growing circle of followers. Now, after enduring these unprovoked attacks for several years, Muhammad finally was forced to put an end to this aggression. He marched his followers back to the city of Mecca, surrounded it, and then waited. He did not attack. Now, when the leaders of Mecca found themselves surrounded by Muhammad's followers, they surrendered without a fight. Muhammad took the city without shedding a drop of blood. And in doing so, a new era had begun. The Islamic State had been born. Now, it was also at this time that the Umayyads found it expedient to join Muhammad's religion. But many accounts say that their conversion to Islam seems to have been more for political reasons than from any profound spiritual awakening. Now, after Muhammad's death, the Umayyads began to use their political influence and their wealth to begin to seize the leadership of Islam. What they couldn't gain by flattery, bribes, political means, or by deceit, they gained by intimidation and murder. Now, one of the most heinous acts that the Umayyads committed in their pursuit of power was when they hunted down and killed the Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of Muhammad. Now, they trapped Hussein and a small band of friends and family as they were traveling near Karbala, Iraq. The Umayyads starved the family members of Muhammad into submission. And when Hussein finally surrendered, the Umayyads summarily executed him. They brutally hacked his head from his body with swords and then proudly paraded his severed head around on the tip of a lance. Now, as we begin to look back at these formative years of Islam, we can see that eventually 12 imams arose, 12 legitimate leaders from Muhammad's family line. Now, all of these 12 were killed as a result of the Umayyads' lust for power. Now, after the Umayyads seized control of Islam, they replaced both the Sunni and the Shia methods of selecting leaders and instead instituted a dynastic line of succession. Thus, the next 15 caliphs of Islam were Umayyads. It became a family succession. The Umayyads and those dynasties who followed in their footsteps succeeded in permanently diverting Islam onto a path which was entirely different than what Muhammad had originally intended. And in doing so, they not only changed the faith of Islam, but they also fulfilled the prophecies given to us by Jesus in the book of Revelation. And this is why this story is so important for us to understand what happened back then in the early days of Islam. This story of the rise of the Umayyads and of the seizing or usurping of the control of the religion of Islam is the real-life fulfillment of the stories found in the book of Revelation, the stories referring to the beast. Now, going back to the stories of the two witnesses and the story of the woman who was pregnant and gave birth to the child who would be the Messiah, both the two witnesses and the woman, were opposed by this beast. Now, the Baha'i writings tell us that the two witnesses were Muhammad and his son-in-law, Ali. And as you may know, Ali was the first of 12 imams. Now, the Baha'i writings also identify the beast of the book of Revelation, the last beast, as the Umayyad dynasty of caliphs. And in the same sense, the pregnant woman who was forced to flee from the beast into the wilderness originally represented the uncorrupted religion of Islam. Now, these are extremely strong and challenging claims. Can these claims be verified? Do these scenes from the book of Revelation actually foretell the corruption of Islam? Let's take a closer look to see just how closely the Umayyads actually do fit the description of the beast given by Jesus in the book of Revelation, and then begin to take a look at how these events affect us today. Now, in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, Jesus, speaking through John, tells us about the beast. He says that the beast was, is, and is yet to arise. Now, the beast who was, from the perspective of John, this was the beast in the past, the beast who had already appeared in the past. Now, if you go back to the book of Daniel, Daniel also refers to a series of beasts. And Daniel identifies these beasts as the successive non-Jewish empires which had conquered and controlled Jerusalem. So in this sense, when in the 17th chapter of John, when John says, or Jesus speaking through John says, refers to the beast of the past, he's apparently referring to the beasts, the empires in the past who had conquered Jerusalem. Now, in the 17th chapter also, John refers to the beast who is. That is, the beast who in John's day had also arisen to conquer Jerusalem, and this was the Roman Empire. And then John, speaking 2,000 years ago, also refers to the beast who is yet to arise. Now, if you look at the history of Jerusalem, you will find that only one empire arose after the Romans to conquer Jerusalem. And this was the Islamic Empire under the leadership of the Umayyads and those dynasties who came after the Umayyads. Now, going back to the specific description of the beast of the book of Revelation, you will see that Jesus told us that the beast from the book of Revelation has seven heads. Now, in real life, the Umayyad dynasty controlled an empire comprising seven dominions. Now, the seven dominions symbolized by the seven heads were Syria, Persia, Egypt, Arabia, North Africa, Spain, and Turkey. Now, in his description, Jesus also told us that the beast has 10 horns. And the Baha'i writings tell us that the 10 horns of this beast signify 10 names. That although there were actually 15 Umayyad rulers, they sometimes shared the same name, or in this case, the same horn. Thus, among the Umayyads, there were only 10 horns, or 10 names of rulers. Now, the book of Revelation also reveals the length of time that the Umayyads would control Islam. In chapter 9, verse 10, it says that this beast had power, quote, power to hurt men 5 months, unquote. Now, using the day for a month principle, 5 prophetic months equals 150 days. That is, 5 times 30 equals 150. And using the day for a year principle, this becomes 150 years. Now, in real life, the Umayyad dynasty exercised power for 150 years. So, once again, the prophecy fits. By the end of this time, the religion of Muhammad had been irretrievably changed. The Umayyads and those dynasties who ruled after them cemented the concept of a dynastic line of succession in opposition to the legitimate line of leadership composed of Muhammad's family members. And also, the Umayyads were only the first in a series of dynasties which controlled Islam for the next 1,200 years. Now, when we begin to consider the many crusades, wars, and battles which were fought between Christians and Muslims down through the centuries, we can see that this beast has also had a profound impact upon its Christian neighbors, both in Asia and in Europe. One pivotal example of this conflict was also foretold in the 9th chapter of the book of Revelation. Now here it says, quote, "The four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men." This is in Revelation 9:15. Now, this prophecy foretold the conquest of Constantinople, the capital of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which effectively, quote, cut off one-third of Christendom. Constantinople was conquered by Muslim forces in 1453 A.D. Now, by 1453, the Christian Church had split into three major branches: the Eastern Orthodox, the Roman Catholic, and the Europeans, who would soon be known as the Protestant Church. The key to understanding this prophecy, once again, lies in its numbers, the numbers a day, a month, and a year. Now, as you probably know, a prophetic day is one day, a prophetic month is 30 days, and a prophetic year is 360 days, and an hour is a fraction of a day. Now, when these numbers are added together, they yield a total of 391 days. That's 1 plus 30 plus 360 equals 391. Now, once again, using our day for a year principle, this total becomes 391 years. So how does this relate to the idea of the conquering of the city of Constantinople? 1453 was the year when Constantinople fell to the Muslims. And when we add 391 years to 1453, once again, we have the year 1844, we have the year which, according to the text of the prophecy, this man-child was supposed to emerge, supposed to assert himself, to announce himself. Now, it also is a fascinating fact that Islam contains prophecies about the year 1260. Now, in Islam, the Promised One is called several things. He's called a Mahdi, he's called a Qayyim, and there are many prophecies concerning his appearance. The date that is repeatedly indicated by Islamic prophecy is the year 1260 AH, or 1260 of the calendar used in Islam. Muhammad's grandson, the Imam Sadiq, when questioned concerning the year in which the Promised One would appear, Imam Sadiq replied, quote, "Verily in the year 60, his cause shall be revealed, and his name shall be noised abroad." Verily in the year / 60, or 1260. Another collection of Islamic messianic prophecy states, quote, "In the year Gars, the earth shall be illumined by his light." And again it says, quote, "In Gars, the tree of divine guidance shall be planted," unquote. In the year Gars. Now, as you may know, words and letters in the Arabic language all have corresponding numerical values. The word Gars is an Arabic word meaning the planting. And interestingly enough, the word Gars also has a numerical value of 1260. So he says, in the year Gars, he will appear. In the year 1260, he will appear. Now, Muslims of the Shia sect also have a prophecy that their 12th Imam would return 1,000 years after he disappeared. This last leader from the family line of Muhammad vanished in the year 260 AH of the Islamic calendar. Once again, when we add 1,000 years to this date, the date when the 12th Imam disappeared, once again we arrive at the year 1260 AH of the Islamic calendar. Now, this is just a brief sampling of the Islamic prophecies which foretold the coming of the Promised One in the year 1260 of the Islamic calendar. Now, earlier, we have seen that some of the other Bible prophecies apparently point to the year 1844 of the Christian calendar, the 2300-day prophecies. And here, we see that the Islamic prophecies point to the year 1260 AH of their calendar. Now, it is an extremely exciting fact that the year 1260 AH of the Islamic calendar is the exact same year 1844 of the Christian calendar. The prophecies of the Zoroastrian, the Jewish, the Christian, and the Islamic religions all converge at the exact same point in history. They all point to the year 1844 AD as the time when the Promised One will appear. What other prophecies are there? One of the major themes, one of the most frequently repeated themes of the entire Bible, is the return of the Jews to Israel. Now, Jesus taught that the Son of Man, the Messiah, will come when the Jews begin to return to Israel. Jesus said, quote, "They, the Jews, shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down to the Gentiles," the non-Jews, "until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Then shall they see the coming of the Son of Man with power and great glory." This is in Luke 21:24. In other words, the Jews will return to Israel when the times of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. In Revelation 11, chapter 11, verse 2, Jesus tells us when the times of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. Jesus says, quote, "The holy city, Jerusalem, shall they tread underfoot 42 months. Now, as we have already seen before, 42 months equals 1,260 days, or in this case, 1,260 years. Now, here's how the prophecy was fulfilled. A few years after the death of Muhammad, the Islamic war machine marched upon the holy city of Jerusalem. Now, when it had become apparent that the Muslims were going to conquer Jerusalem, the Christian bishop Sophronius placed the condition on the bloodless surrender of the city. And this condition was that the Jews would be strictly excluded from Israel. Now, this agreement was enforced by the Muslims for over 1,200 years. Now, over 1,200 years later, in the year 1260 AH of the Islamic calendar, or 1844 of the Christian calendar, the Caliph of the Islamic Empire, then residing in the captured city of Constantinople, this Caliph was forced by foreign powers to sign a document called the Edict of Toleration. This edict legally allowed the Jews to return to the Holy Land for the first time in more than 12 centuries. Now, in his book, Light for the Last Days, a Christian Bible scholar named E.G. Guinness adds these additional fascinating insights. Quote, Mr. Guinness says, quote, "The Edict of Toleration was published in the 1260th year of the Muslim calendar. It is dated March 21, 1844. This date is the first of Nisan in the Jewish calendar and is exactly 2,300 years from the first of Nisan 457 BC, on the day which Ezra states that he left Babylon in compliance with the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, given in the seventh year of Artaxerxes' reign." Can you see what he just said here? The 2,300 day, or the 2,300 year abomination of desolation prophecy, referred to by Jesus as the time of his second coming, and the prophecies ending the time of the Gentiles, the 42-month, 1,260-day prophecies. These two prophecies, or these prophecies, were all fulfilled on the exact same day in 1844. The prophecies have been given, in one instance, 2,000 years before, and in another instance, more than 1,200 years before, and they were fulfilled on the exact same day in 1844. The Jews have returned to Israel, and these prophecies have all been fulfilled. Now, Moses gave us yet another prophecy which foretells the year 1844. In Leviticus, where Moses gives us the law of God, in Leviticus 26:28-33, Moses then warns that if you do not remain faithful to this law, and if you revert back to paganism, Moses warns, quote, "I will chastise you seven times for your sins. I will make your cities waste. I will scatter you among the heathen." Now again, the secret of this prophecy lies in the number seven times. Now, earlier we have established that a time is a cycle of 360 days. Seven times, therefore, using our day for your principle, would then have to equal 2,520 years. That's 7 years times 360 days in a year. That's 2,520 days, or 2,520 years. Now, here's how this prophecy was fulfilled. In the 6th century B.C., an evil Hebrew king arose in Judah, whose governing policies directly led to the fall of Jerusalem and to the enslavement of his people. This Hebrew king's name was Manasseh. Now, for the first time in history since Moses gave this prophecy, during Manasseh's reign, the religion of Moses was outlawed. Instead of the worship of the one true God, local pagan cults were promoted. Now, King Manasseh is said to have consecrated pagan altars within the Temple of Solomon, and he even allowed ritual prostitution within the temple itself. He reportedly also instituted human sacrifice, sacrificing his own young son to the pagan god Moloch. Now, it wasn't long before the punishment, quote, for your sins, foretold by Moses, came upon him. Jerusalem indeed was, quote, laid waste by the Assyrian army, and Manasseh himself was one of many who were, quote, scattered among the heathen, unquote, when he was carried off in chains to Babylon. This was the beginning of the Great Tribulation, which was to see the wholesale enslavement and the disintegration of the Jewish nation. Now, according to William Miller, who is a prominent Christian Bible scholar, this prophecy of Moses took effect about 676 or 677 BC, when Manasseh was taken captive to Babylon. Now, if we use the year 676, 677 BC as the starting point of the seven times prophecy, and if we do count forward 2,520 years, the seven times, once again, we arrive at the year 1844. Now, to summarize what we have discovered so far, a total of 15 separate messianic prophecies which span 3,000 years, several countries, and four distinct religions have been explained. Moses, Daniel, Zoroaster, Jesus, and Muhammad all foretold the coming of the Promised One in 1844 of the Christian calendar, or 1260 of the Islamic calendar. Now, this remarkable convergence of prophecy is totally unique in religious history, and this is the secret that was hidden for centuries by the mysterious prophetic numbers. 1844 was the year when the Promised One was due to appear. That's all the time we have for today. Please come back next time, because next time we will be talking about the actual fulfillment of the prophecies, about what happened in 1844, and about the coming of this Promised One. So please come back.